So welcome everyone tonight, a special welcome to Rabbi Noach Goldstein, the Rosh Beit Midrash of the YU Torah Tzion Kollel. For those who don't know me, my name is Zvi Engel. I'm Zocha to serve as the Rabbi of Congregation Or Torah. And we're looking for opportunities to try to introduce Rabbi Goldstein to our shul and to, let's say, Anshei Shlomenu, to learn some Torah from him and with him. Owing to COVID, many of our shuls, and Or Torah is no exception in this regard, we're making the most of it as best we can, but of course we want to make sure to stay safe, and our guidelines thus far have prevented us from having our usual close engagement in person with members of the YU Torah Tzion Kollel. So it's a privilege to be able to be on the call today, tonight with you, Rabbi Goldstein, and just to set the frame a little bit, the two of us share not only an affinity for, but also a kinship in our common relationship with Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, Rav Aaron ben Yechiel, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, whose Yurtzeit is coming up on the 1st of Iyar. I wish everyone Chodesh Tov tonight as we're going into the first day of Rosh Chodesh. So the second day is indeed Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Yurtzeit. So I thought maybe we should jump right in, Rabbi Goldstein. We talked, of course, in advance a little bit. It's 6 years since he passed away. And I think anyone who interacted with Rav Lichtenstein has many different facets about him that one could speak about. And I'm wondering what's on your mind, some themes perhaps that come to mind 6 years, the 60 Earth site we're coming up to, in terms of the enduring legacy of Rav Lichtenstein. And I'll say it very personally for you as a Ben Torah, as Rosh Beit Midrash here in Chicago, working under the aegis of the YU Torah Tzion Kollel together with the Rosh Kollel, Rabbi Reuven Brand. What are some of your thoughts?
So it's a heavy topic. It's crazy that it's already been 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, I think the first thing, kind of coming out of something you mentioned, it seems to me like everyone who crossed paths with Rav Lichtenstein, it could be that they were in yeshiva for 10 years. It could be that they saw him once running from the bus to yeshiva. The largest or the smallest interactions, it seems like everyone who crossed his path was profoundly moved.
I have that sense also. You know, a few years ago, there was this book put out by, I would say at this point, a somewhat controversial, maybe more controversial individual who wrote for the New York Times for many years, David Brooks. So, you know, he has this book, The Road to Character. And the book, at the very first page of the book, he says, I'm going to formulate, you know, the idea about what I'm trying to talk about by an essay by a certain rabbi named Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik called Lonely Man of Faith. And he starts unpacking Adam 1, Adam 2. He does it for his own purposes. But I thought to myself, reading this book, each chapter is about a person who's not only their teaching, but what they embodied and the lessons, the legacy that they left was itself of enduring meaning for generations in each chapter. And I thought, wow, exactly on the lines of what you're saying. If I was writing such a book, my book would of necessity include many of my Rebbeim, but Rav Lichtenstein, in a certain way, surpassing them all in terms of that quality. I want to could drill down a little bit about that. You know, you and I talked previously, and it's in the air in general. We talk about ethics, morals within our society. And one of the issues I think that animates us very much is the question of, as Jews, of tzedakah. And tzedakah touches on so many different elements of who we are as Jews, as Americans. You and I discussed this a little bit in advance. I'm curious, some of your thoughts. Rav Lichtenstein was asked years ago to parse a question about Jewish philanthropy and Jewish philanthropy versus universal philanthropy. And are those two at loggerheads with each other? When do they come into conflict? How does a Jew think about tzedakah when you live in a broader society in which we, I think this is part of the legacy of our Rebbe, we care. We need to care about the society at large, and yet there's a reality.
Wasn't a coincidence that he was the one who got that question.
Pardon?
Wasn't a coincidence that he was the one who got that question.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, and there is in the various books that were posthumously published, actually the last one, certainly posthumously published, and very much with thanks to someone who grew up actually in Skokie, I'll mention, Rabbi Dov Carroll, who served for years as basically not only Talmud Muvhak of Moreno v'Rabbeinu, but also was Mishamesh him in so many ways, yeah, and in years of infirmity. So he helped edit these books, the varieties of Jewish experience. And he was actually, one of the essays is actually about this exact topic. Tell me a little bit about what your thoughts are about some of the ways in which the question gets posed and how Rav Lichtenstein, walk me through, what does Rav Lichtenstein do with it? Let's take that as a good test case.
So before we even get into that, I thought, you know, just tell everyone, it was fascinating and so telling that when we were talking to each other, trying to figure out what topic we want to choose from, and there are so many, I mean, you know, talk about Rabbi Carroll put together the Rav Lichtenstein bibliography of his writings, and there are like 1,000 different essays. And it turns out that both of us on his first year had given shiurim on Rav Lichtenstein's view of staka.
Davka. Yeah.
Right?
Like, it touches on so many of these things, right?
Exactly. You know, the question of ben adam l'chaveiro, ben adam l'makom, the care for the individual, the care for society, the balancing of priorities, which in general, in his whole, you know, life and hashkafa was, you know, we want to learn in depth. We want to learn from the society around us. We see opportunities to grow. How many times he'd say that his hashkafa, really what he got from the Rav, was not looking at the world as a minefield, a world of threats and sins and problems to be avoided, but a world of opportunities for growth, opportunities for impact. And of course, the downside of that is that there's only so much you can do with the resources we have available. So I thought that was one, a few main reasons why tzedakah specifically seems to have been a topic that really spoke with him.
Yeah. And it spoke to both of us. Interesting. The first year at site, I think we actually both parsed the same essay, and not this essay from Varieties of Jewish Experience, but from, I think it's from Minchat Aviv. It talks about Yitzhaka and Eretz Yisrael. And these are issues that just touch on, as you said, some of these meta themes about Rav Lichtenstein. Let's get into the essay maybe a little bit and try to walk people through some of the basic ideas in it, and you know, some personal reflections maybe will come up along the way as well. So, of course,
we gotta start with the very beginning. He takes on the question, right?
Right. There's always a period at the beginning of analysis in every essay, and frankly, every shir, every sugya begins with, what are the questions? How do we formulate the question? What's behind the question? What animates the question? What I thought was telling here was, there seemed to be, he was almost kind of trying to, how shall I say, unmask a hidden agenda of, let's not talk about halacha here, right?
Right. We're just trying to talk about values, the question of, should we be prioritizing giving within the community versus giving outside of the community to broader causes without an analysis of Jewish charity law.
Right.
And he's even a little bit funny in the beginning of it.
To the extent of Lichtenstein never opened with a joke, which was, I think, rather rare. In all honesty, that's part of the biography as well. No, really, I'm not going to really talk about Jewish values separate and distinct from the world of the halacha. The whole warp and woof of Judaism is animated by, how do we walk? How do we move forward? What is the prism, the lens through which we see the whole world? So you're not gonna entrap me there, are you? You know. There's another essay, I still remember the title. It's at the very beginning of the first Leaves of Faith, the first volume, Why Learn Gemara? ? You know, and he opens 2.5 pages of, why learn Gemara? Why breathe? What kind of a question is, you know, that's like the beginning, it's the first salvo. You know, what kind of a question is that? You know, so does it mean why learn Gemara as opposed to learning Chumash? Does it mean as opposed to learning Greek philosophy? Is it, what, you know, and, you know, why Gemara? Why not start with, and then he starts going through, why learn Gemara? Why not start with the Shulchan Aruch? Why not start with Achronim? Why not start with Poskeis Manenu? Why are we starting first with that baseline? Why is that, right? And he goes into a whole analysis. So there's really something there, just even in the methodology of, you're confronting a phenomenon. What is the question? What is the question you're being asked? What does it mean? What are its categories? I will say, and this
was an amazing listener.
For sure. One of the liabilities, though, in some of these shiur for me was there's so much time spent on formulating the question that afterwards you're always like, but we're out of time. We never got to, you know, come back next time. Yeah. So oftentimes there's that sense of, you know, there's so much time analyzing. I see it. And did you learn with Rav Rosenzweig as well?
Many years. Yeah.
Yeah. So Rav Rosenzweig, Lahalda ben Achan ben Achayim, he takes that to the nth degree. Right? If Ravaran Zetzal put it on one plane, Rav Rosenzweig should be taking it like to the next level. He learned it from his rabbi. Learned well. Let's talk about a bit of a touchy subject about Stucca. Rav Lichtenstein deals with it head on, and that is the reality that the Torah does make mention very overtly twice, Parshat Bahar and Parshat Re'eh, that the indigent person, at least ab initio, is achicha. It's a fellow Jew.
Fellow Jew, which is where he comes back to at the end also, but he doesn't shy away from it. You know, that he's not somebody of apologetics whatsoever. He says, I look at the original psukim, the original, the Shulchan Aruch, there's no question. The priority in tzedakah overwhelmingly focuses within the community. But then you have that record scratch, right? Classic, takes a giant step back and says, look at Avram Avinu, right? So many more basic, how could it be that the world of Gemilas Chasadim, which was founded before Matan Torah, of course it applies beyond just the Jewish community in of itself. Right? I think
he didn't say this wouldn't have written this ever in an essay, but when I read that now, and I went back, of course, to review the essay again over Shabbos. I went through it again. There's the mitzvahs that we learned that are explicit in the Torah. And then there are the values from the greats who embodied those values and espoused them for the way they lived. It's his characterization of Avram Avinu. I mean, it's obvious in Parshat Vayera, that's exactly what Kodesh Baruch Hu describes Avram Avinu as. With Rabbeinu, that's sort of that broad approach. There was an episode, a very, very sad and terrible episode, but it did transpire, where a Quran was burned in Eretz Yisrael. I don't know if you know this story. A Quran was burned. It's years ago. Maybe it was a mosque.
This is like the year after I left yeshiva, I think.
Yeah, so you know about this, right? Yes. I don't know if everyone on the call has a story. Rav Aaron went with the Quran in hand to present to the community, to the Muslim community. And one of the Talmidim who was not there, but who spoke to him afterward, you know, it was obvious why he did it. I mean, by the way, you can look up after this talk. You're welcome to look up online, right? In Jerusalem Post. I mean, he talked about it. He said, this is a terrible Chil Hashem. And I felt I had to make redress in some way. And I said, and I brought them Quran. But one of the Talmidim spoke to him. I don't want to say the name because I don't want to get it wrong. One of the Talmidim who had another halachic issue around the same time asked him, you know, what should I do, Rabbi? He said, you should ask yourself, what would Avram Avinu do in this situation? And when you read in this essay about Stucca that Rav Aaron's writing, like, yeah, it says, it says, patort, tiftach, you know, and it has to do with your brother. But come on, what was Avram Avinu about?
About learning Tanakh seriously, which was another major point of emphasis for him. So often he would focus, and that's one of the reasons why the Ramban spoke so deeply to him, was to get a sense of the Avos and the Imahos, get a sense of who these people were and learn Absolutely. And learn from them.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that carried over to learning from everybody. You know, he was somebody who looked to the greats, looked to the giants, and at the same time was listening to whatever he was is listening to people.
Amazing.
He was
there's that ancient, in my view, it's an ancient story. Maybe some of the people on the call know the story. It's called ancient, but it's before my time and your time, that he went out to to demonstrate on behalf of the people of Biafra. It's a famous episode at the Yeshiva, it's still at Reitz, where he felt it was so important. That being said, by the way, and interesting, and here
you know, the background to that, though, I think I heard this from Rabbi Billet that he
Billet.
He took the shear to go protest. And it was it was cold and basically the shear was the only ones protesting, but they got up for Vasikin to have the 2-hour shear before they went.
Right. So that's what I was gonna say, and this is the triage of values. I hope I'm not projecting or retrojecting incorrectly. I do not believe that if Moreno Rabbeinu was still in the world today, that's a counterfactual statement in of itself. Like, what does that mean? That he was going to be some kind of social justice warrior. This was not his way. And I know that I was going to say that the day he's going out to a rally, don't think that's instead of learning. That's after. That's after to our session of learning. And it, by no means was he, constantly making protests and marches and things like that. Was not his way. But you see in this essay about Stockholm, but we have to care. And you made the point to me, we were chatting about the Avodat Hashem, the actual service of Hashem by people who are not directly of the B'nai Avraham faiths.
Yeah, I thought that was something unique. And I thought that we would approach this from, we care for every person, Tzelem Elohim, and therefore we have obligations to help all of humanity. But he also focuses not just on helping non-Jews from a strict Ben Adam L'Chaveiro Chesed perspective, but he says we have their Avodas Hashem to think about. We have their religious obligations to think about. I think we talked about this also, but there's this amazing story in the book Mevakshei Panacha that Rabbi Sabato from Al Adumim put out, conversations that he had with Rav Lichtenstein. And it's in the first or second one where Rav Lichtenstein is talking about the importance of the Ramban to him and how much of his Hashkafa he draws on the Ramban and complexity. And he says, one example is the Ramban's view of non-Jews and the value, the spiritual value they have. He talks about the Ramban's position that they have to observe all of Choshen Mishpat. And then he tells a story. He says, it was a couple of years earlier, the yeshiva was running Yom Iyun, a special day that was dedicated to Bein Yisrael La'amim. So the yeshiva was focusing on Jewish and non-Jewish relations. And I think they wanted him to talk about saving a non-Jew on Shabbos, you know, more narrow, very important, obviously, but more narrow technical issues. And he said, if I'm going to speak, we're going to talk about what does Avodas Hashem mean for non-Jews?
Wow.
Right. Which I think about it more, Bangle. I think it really, there are like 2 points, I think, that I really take out of that. Number one is his universal value for people from a religious perspective. But also number two is his real, more than anyone I've ever met, we talk about having a relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, and for him, that really, really meant it on such a deep level. You saw the connection. He lived with God.
Yeah.
And when you really feel that way, he gets up in the morning, and that's what you want everyone else to have as well.
Yeah.
I think it was
for sure
universal value, and also recognize, you know, having Hashem at the absolute center of his existence.
Yeah. I'm curious. We're both Talmidim, let's say, from different eras. Do you think
that ever got... were you in yeshiva again? Were you in the
shiva? I was there in the early 90s, 92, okay. 93.
Yeah.
Which was actually around the time when Oslo started, and then Rav Amital became a Sar. And I'm curious. Well, I want to stay focused on Rav Lichtenstein, so I don't want to go too far afield. But do you think that got him in trouble with what I would call, broadly speaking, the rest of, however you want to define that, the rest of the quote-unquote Olam HaTorah? Meaning, when you reflect on it, when you reflect on that kind of broad-mindedness and, you know, his identification with the Ramban and, you know, the idea that, as you're saying, he had this universal, there was a universalist streak to him, which was not just because that was his character. It was because this is what he understood was the value and the direct of the Torah. Do you think it put him sort of at bay from others, from other Rabbanim, from the rest of quote unquote the Olam HaTorah? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I definitely don't feel super knowledgeable about that, but I do think that there was a basic distinction between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. And I think that in Israel, that was a real divide. in the religious Zionist community.
He has some lines. One of the sichot where he says something like, "I'm not, in America, I was considered too Zionistic. When I got to Eretz Yisrael, so there are people cast aspersions that I'm not Zionistic enough because the particular definition of Zionism that and he said. Therefore, I consider myself a religious Zionist, but doesn't mean I'm aligned with all of the ways in which it manifests. It was just very interesting.
Yeah,
you know, and I would say he was willing to my mind, I think he was that was one of the kochot that he had. This is what he believed. This is what he was, and. He was willing to shoulder that. And I can say, I thought there was an element of moral courage in that, if you will. It would have been easier to go along to get along. There were various things that happened without going into too many tragedies, things like that, where let's say the vast majority of his religious Zionist colleagues simply did not deviate from each other. I don't care. I'm going to do it. Some of these were painful. I can give you an example that I think both of us were around for. Both of us as Talmidim there was a story of a prominent rabbi in the religious Zionist world who was engaging in incredibly inappropriate behavior and was sexually abusing others.
I came back to visit the yeshiva actually right when that was happening.
Yeah, tremendously painful parsha. Ravarn felt how could he you know, it's sort of the idea of the dimata shukim, that the tears of the oppressed were going to be left untended, was not one that he could abide, and he didn't. I think at a certain personal cost, within his sunset years, he sort of wants to, you know, go along to get along. No, to the last, right. He was still, you know,
and even more amazing is that it's not like he was a combative personality.
Oh, I didn't, you know,
he was very, very much a heavy mitamidav shel Aharon, Rodef Shalom.
Ishmo kein hu.
But exactly.
Ishmo kein hu. Now, when it came to the issue in this particular article about Stucco, where they're trying to sort of pigeonhole him, well, Rabbi Lichtenstein, who is a graduate of Harvard, no doubt you will be able to speak with us in the level of values. And he said, what are you talking about? I'm just going to talk about halacha. So the idea that he identified from a values perspective with the notions of universalism, not because they were just part of the zeitgeist, but because he thought he taught his Talmidim. This is what it means to be a Ben Avraham and Sarah. But then when he got down to the halachic component, right, he did actually become a little more, I would say, formulated of necessity.
I was surprised how clear and direct his conclusion was. Mm. Right. Often in his pieces, there's a broadness, there's a thorough evaluation of all the different sides. You know, the Gemara Shir, where you're trying to understand how many ways we can understand the Gemara, the conclusions are often less focused. But here I thought he came to a pretty frank conclusion on the question.
Do we want to tell anybody what it is, or should we make them all read the article?
Hopefully people will be excited enough to want to read it on their own, but we can ruin the ending. It's still worth it.
I think we should tell them anyway. I don't want to keep them in suspense too much. And they'll say, I don't know, I came to this shiur and then they gave me a bunch of different ideas and they didn't like tachlis. And what does Lichtenstein say in the end?
He says the priority should be giving internally, but same time, also have to be giving externally as well.
I mean, he explained why. He said various reasons why. I mean, he didn't just leave it sort of, but in the end, you know, that's Allah. He explained whether it's because of the realities of how we live as a community, our paucity of numbers and the fact that we have to support our own. He used the example of either Mishkan or Aniyim. The fact that the Rambam and Hilchot Matnon Aniyim interweaves the issues of how to take care of the poor and the indigent with issues related to donations, if you will, and gifts that are going to support Jewish community. The reality that this is what we're up to now as a community. Now it's interesting. I thought he was also making the point that this was not even a subject in the Middle Ages, because no one's taking Jewish money, you know, to better society per se. It wasn't that concept didn't exist. And today we do have that. And yet he felt today we still have to prioritize Jewish causes. You know, I took a lesson. I will tell you, I took a lesson in this. I tried to be with every bar and bat mitzvah in the shul a few weeks before the Bar and Bat Mitzvah. And I'd read this essay years ago, and I came back on Shabbos. I said, that's where I got the idea. I tell each kid, we have to care. Yeah, but I silly me, right? I didn't even say in the name of Rav Lichtenstein, but I would say, we have to care about the trees because Kosh Baruch Hu made them. We have to care about the whales. We have to care about the animals. We have to care about, and we have to care about people. We have to care about people in our town. We have to care about Aniyei Ircha. I explained to Aniyei Ircha Kodmin that those who are poor in your city, it doesn't differentiate between Jews and non-Jews. It means the people who are local, and they try to take care of them, et cetera. But then I point out to them, we're a tiny little, statistically speaking, as far as those who do these kinds of things, we seem to be a very small people. And the people, the fine people who live in, pick a place, Norway, China, Australia, why are they going to give to Medinat Yisrael? Why are they going to support our institutions? We don't expect them to do that. We have to do that. And if we're not going to do, so I tell them, you know, make a mutual fund of tzedakah. It's not all or nothing, but you really, you have to, if you're not going to take care of the chesed organizations, in our case, in Chicago. So who's going to do that? We have to do that. We have to take care of, and it's not to the exclusion of, but it, and I, but I was trying to point out to them, but you should feel that all things being equal, yeah, we do care about the whole world. We don't want to save everybody, but we are stuck a little bit making, you know, sort of a triage.
Priorities have to be made, right?
Yeah.
And it's not just abstract statements. Like he's very clear. There should be giving to universal causes. Just, you know, I thought it was really very similar to his whole view of Torah and secular studies.
Good.
Where I'm back. You know, where, so we'll open it all the time. He would when people would ask him, you know, it's very nice to learn Shakespeare or Milton, but shouldn't you learn another Daf of Gemara? So he would, you know, give the analogy in response of you're at a meal with someone and they have two slices of bread and you ask to please pass the butter. And the person says to you, fool, what's more important, butter or bread? Of course, bread. So don't take butter, take a third slice of bread.
Right.
Right. He's pointing out that there's a certain simplicity in that approach, and that you need to draw on different topics for different strengths, even as there's no question where your priorities are. So I thought that there was a really very similar approach towards this topic of tzedakah as well. The inter-Jewish community, tzedakah is the bread, right? And he's, as we said, he's not shying away from that. He's not covering that up or hiding at all. That is what the priority has to be. At the same time, there needs to be butter. There needs to be butter on the table. The real, real important piece.
It was still jam. So at some point he changed from jam to butter, but I remember with jam. We said, well, I would like some jams. No, have another piece of bread. But you're kidding aside.
I'm not sure the jam was really jam or the butter was really butter.
Well, whatever. That's another shear. But this Vihi Hanakuda, you know, I remember once in one of the press conferences they would call, you could ask him any questions. Yeah. You know, he said at some point that if someone were to ask him to summarize what he learned at Harvard, I mean, I was expecting to say, you know, something about Milton, Henry Moore. Sorry, are we back?
We're back.
I lost you there. I took a commercial break. I didn't realize I was going to be doing that.
10-second station notification.
Tonight's talk brought to you by bread and butter and jam and whatever. He was asked, what did you learn at Harvard? You know, I was expecting he was going to say in response something about you know, the rational theology of Henry Moore. He was going to talk about Milton. He said one word: complexity.
Complexity.
Now this always struck me because I thought, you didn't learn complexity in the base medrash? Of course, learned complexity in the base medrash. But he understood when he got, I think, this, what I took away from this is he had a new perspective on the complexity of the world such as it is, and understood that our place as Jews in it is complex, but shouldn't be, as you opened. So you know, I'm invoking it. The world is not a minefield. If you want to view the world as a minefield, it's always us and them. That's one thing. But if you want to view things in a much more positive light and a much more optimistic light, and not for the sake of being naive, but for the sake of we have something to contribute and we have an ongoing relationship with the world, as he would quote from Robert Frost, a lover's quarrel with the world, right? But that it continues and that we do need to figure out at every turn a balance. But also I think the balance was not shakul. It wasn't even. He still thought the emphasis was more in a Judaic vein. I see we're already running short on time. So if anyone wants to type in questions or comments, feel free. And I'll field them as we keep talking a couple more minutes over here. Just the idea that you mentioned this, you referenced this when we spoke earlier, I think, about the idea that he can't give you all the answers in an essay. No essay is going to give you the answers, but that we do need to make recourse to the first class. I think you call the first class postgame. That's your line. Yeah. To navigate. Right.
Which right. So at the end, he says, you know, when you get to the specific details, so he says, you know, we have to analyze every case on a case by case basis. As mentioned before, complexity, you know, we need to, the individual donor circumstances, the causes that are there. We're not going to sit down in one essay and write a detailed program for everybody. Yeah. You know, this is general orientations here, but there's a lot more work to be done. And the faith he had in first class postgame to formulate those responses.
You know? Yeah. What's interesting is, and this is another essay and probably for another discussion, but he actually, Rav Lichtenstein was also concerned, and this is so counterintuitive on the face of it, not just with the donor and the donor's responsibilities, but what are the recipient's responsibilities?
Yeah.
And there's an article, I think it was like Ma'ariv or something a few years ago, it was entitled Tzedakah, Not Welfare, something like that. You know, he talked about the distinction between a society animated by values of tzedakah versus a welfare state and what the differences were between the two of them in terms of a call not only to help, but also on the call of being helped, a call to step up and take, you know, whatever steps a person could take to ameliorate the situation and the like. And you have that reality, that balance. It's another layer of complexity in tzedakah. There's a recipient on the other side.
And I also saw a couple of anecdotes in on that front. One, I remember once I was in yeshiva, I think, and he somehow healthcare came up, and he made the comment that he couldn't imagine on a moral view how you could have a wealthy first world country that does not provide universal healthcare.
Wow. You
know? Now you could go into all the economic analysis, et cetera, but you know, his first response was, you know, just morally, how could that be? The answer might be because it can't be, but That was his dominant view. At the same time, I never got to see this. I don't know, maybe if you did, you know, in the yeshiva a few years earlier than I was there. But I heard stories that, especially when Rav Lichtenstein lived in Yerushalayim, that some of the aniyim in Yerushalayim loved him because they would come and it would be people who, you know, you or me, most people would look at it as a nice farf. You know, maybe I'll take like 5 shekel out of my pocket, if that much.
Yeah.
And he would sit down with them, write them a check for who knows how much money, but at the same time, give them a pep talk, you know, you can turn your life around, you can get a job, like really, really thought it was necessary to invest in these people, but also had faith that they could become something.
Okay. So I'm going to tell you a story. Reina Rabbeinu didn't tell so many stories. He wasn't into Meiselach per se. Yeah. And I don't mean to convert our Rebbe. You know, that's the Hasidic Rebbe, which was just Meiselach. Not that that's a bad thing, that has its place, but that wasn't Rav Aharon. But I will tell you, and back to the original point that we were both making about, you know, it's a personality that you learn so much from. Rav Shai Lichtenstein said, I think it was in one of the Hespedim, that there was a period of 2 to 3 years when Rav Lichtenstein lived in Yerushalayim where he could not learn at night because there were so many people ringing the bell.
Hmm.
And he said something like, I can't even tell you most of the stories. Nobody even believed these stories, what they meant about what was going on. Often on the way home from Shtiblach, he davened at Shtiblach, we lived in Yerushalayim, there were people who would just trail him home. And the idea that here was this gadol b'Torah, he never got angry, he never got agitated. My friend's brother, Michael Eisenberg, who is today a prominent businessman in Yerushalayim and a Talmud Chacham of note in his own right, but a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein, he told the following story that I think embodies so many of these elements that we're talking about tonight. Michael Eisenberg says that he was at Rav Lichtenstein's house in Alon Shvut when Rav Lichtenstein and Dr. Tova, Lo Havda Ben Chaim, had already moved to a lunch food. And the story of Michael Eisenberg tells as follows. The doorbell rings and Rav Lichtenstein was meeting with Michael Eisenberg, but he got up and he went to the door. Of course, he answered it himself. Obvious. Not obvious for every Gadol B'Yisrael, but for Rav Aaron, obvious. And it was an Avrech Kolel at the door. And Michael Eisenberg says, I can hear the conversation because I'm not that far away. It's not that big an apartment. And Rav Lichtenstein and the Chassan says, I'm getting married. I need money. Rav Lichtenstein says to him, do you want to have a profession? So the young man apparently was very impatient and it was completely lost on him that Rav Lichtenstein was actually asking him, are you thinking about doing something to support yourself? And Rav Lichtenstein continued and he said to him, you know, without a profession, you can't support your wife and your family. And you do plan to have a family, right? So the fellow answered Rav Lichtenstein, maybe a little more than irreverently, of course I do. It's a mitzvah, you know. So Rav Lichtenstein said to him, you know, so maybe you should learn also a miktsoa, because that's going to be important to fulfill this mitzvah. The man said to him, the gedolim say that all you have to do is learn Torah. Hashem will take care of the parnasa. So Michael Eisenberg said, I'm listening to this conversation, and obviously the person has no idea who they're talking to, and he said, I'm getting hot under the collar. He said, Rav Lichtenstein took out a bill from his pocket, and he gave it to the young man. Closed the door, he came back to the table. Michael Eisenberg said to him, Rebbe, I'm sorry, why are you giving to these people? They're taking advantage of you. They have no hishtadlus, they're not even trying, and you're just encouraging their delinquency by giving them this money. You should have turned them out. Why did you do this? Rav Lichtenstein said to him that he could not sleep at night, living with the possibility that someone else would go to sleep hungry, or that maybe he had misjudged this other person. And that's what you hear. Like that's the story. That right there. That little maisa. Like right. Really, you're right, but.
The whole ideological not working piece drove him absolutely crazy.
Yeah, drove him crazy.
He would talk about it and write about it. All that being said,
he couldn't
stay. He couldn't sleep at night.
Yeah. Amazing. And this was a really serious. He lived with this. Now it's funny. Michael Eisenberg has like an epilogue to the story. He said on the last night of the Shiva. Of Rav Lichtenstein's Shiva, Michael Eisenberg was in his house and his doorbell rang. And who was at the door? A fellow asking for more financial help, a guy who had already come before Pesach. He was back again a second time. And Michael Eisenberg says, I was a second away from saying to him, you know, you came already. It's just a few weeks ago. He said, but he thought of Rav Lichtenstein. And he asked the man, you know, what are you doing to earn a living? And he said to him, you know what? It's the week of the Shiva for Rav Lichtenstein. Let me give it to you again. How could I not? Now listen to what happened next. Meister Shahaya. Michael Eisenberg says, the fellow, he gives him the money and the fellow says to him, and I'm only quoting the story, so I'm not Chalila trying to be disrespectful. The man at the door gets the money and he says to Michael Eisenberg, Aaron Lichtenstein? I used to collect from him when we lived down the block around the corner. And he always gave me. He was always so nice to me. All those years, the guy didn't even know this is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He's going to stuff. So he says, I heard that he died. And I heard there were hespedim on the radio. So I listened to the hespedim. I didn't know he was a gadol in Torah. You know, the man says to Michael Eisenberg, he didn't even look like one. And what hespedim from his children we heard, he said, and they're all lamdanim. You know, I wanted to go to the kavura. I couldn't make it. It was in a lunch food. So this guy's in Yerushalayim. He says to Michael Eisenberg, did you know him? Were you his Talmud? So Michael Eisenberg said, yeah, I knew him. I was his Talmud. So he put out his hand. You know, that's the characteristic kind of a story. And you see the hashpa'a also in terms of, you know, how to deal with others. I think it was at the Levi itself that Rav Bick said, you know, he was mekabel on himself. He accepted upon himself to give tzedakah with simcha, just like Rav Lichtenstein, like his rabbi did, you know. And there's something to that. There's something, more than something. So that's the legacy of a great master and teacher.
Yeah,
you know, to be sure. So a lot to unpack. Rabbi Kupchik is on the call with us, and I thank you for writing in a question. Did either of us ever hear him talk about his opinion on yeshiva guys not doing the army? Okay, there's an essay. I don't remember him ever. Do you remember Rabbi Goldstein? Did he ever mention it?
like, it didn't come up in the yeshiva, you know, I mean, it was the yeshivat has there. So everyone there was going to the army. And I think it was telling that he led a yeshiva, which told the guys to leave yeshiva and go fight in the army.
Yeah.
You know, there is the whole article on the ideology of a yeshivat has there.
That's what I was thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the ideology of Hester essay, you know, is also Meafien characterizes his approach.
Right.
I believe,
and it really comes back to the things we're talking about, right?
Yeah,
you need to learn. You need to learn, and you need to defend the country, right? So Hester being a model, which, you know, you have some of this and you have some of that. And we're spending 3.5 years in learning, or spending 1.5 years in the army, right? The priority is in learning, but you need to have both. Really, another example.
Yeah.
Of that.
By the way, it was another issue that also at times there was almost like, not at times, there was in at a certain moment when the Mechina programs, for those who know what it is in Israel, started becoming more, were becoming ascendant in a certain way. You know, there was almost like a criticism. Well, someone else is doing 3 years. You're not doing a full 3 years. It's, you know, but he really, I think he did fundamentally believe that sitting and learning is also not only, but also part of what characterizes a nation that lives al admat kodesh and that wants to be in a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and that the Tzva Hagana Yisrael is no contradiction to including people who are sitting and learning. He didn't think, though, that meant that Talmidim should not go to learn to the army. There were no exemptions if you were the best student in the yeshiva, things like that. You know, and when you think about what that means, you know, there's this story. There's a long essay about the morality factors and issues about Chiyat Amalek, the destruction of Amalek, that they did a whole also Yom Yun in the Gush a number of years ago, and they quoted that Rav Lichtenstein had an interaction. Where he explained that, you know, that they came to Ben Gurion, and Ben Gurion was very into Tanakh, and he said, come on, you look in the Tanakh, Yoshua bin Nun never learned anything in Tanakh, he's just a warrior. So they said to Mar Ben Gurion, you spend a lot of time learning Tanakh, you're well known to be a scholar of Tanakh yourself. Would you like it if your biography will just say he was the prime minister and he was no more than a politician, he knew nothing about our culture? You know, it's the same kind of idea, but Rav Lichtenstein felt there's really going to be a priority on Limud HaTorah, and that priority does not exhaust one from the responsibility towards the Klal.
And it's ironic, specifically Yeshua, because I think in the article he highlights Yeshua as Dafka a model.
Yeah, yeah.
Another
Tanakh. Yeah, exactly. Now, by the way, someone wrote in I don't know if I'm allowed to say the name, so I don't want to say names if I'm not authorized, but someone just wrote in that someone was in his shir in YU yet from Mikad Mazdana before he met Aliyah, that you couldn't sit by and let others risk their lives to defend you. It's that sense of achrayut, this person wrote. That's vihihi ha'inyan. And it still meant, again, when push came to shove, Rav Lichtenstein did not become a general in Tzahal. But he certainly was, in my view, an aluf ha'Torah, a commander of Torah in our generation. And for all of his many, many Talmidim, there's so much more to say about other aspects of Moreinu v'Rabbeinu. I hope no one should take away from tonight, well, they summed him up. There's so much more to speak about. Okay.
We've scratched the surface on one topic. I mean, we could talk about Stuck on Eretz Yisrael for another hour easily.
Right.
That's just one topic among many.
And, you know, Chaval da'avdin. Woe unto us that we've lost him on one level. On another level, I think that he was very much always attempting to remind his Talmidim that their responsibility was to the Klal, not only in terms of Tzahal, but also to enter careers, hopefully, that engaged in being mechanech others and teaching others about Torah, and to do so in a serious way and a sincere way. And he really lived that. And that was the passion that he brought to bear in learning, and also the sense of depth and complexity to addressing and confronting so many of the challenges of a complex world.
And just thinking going forward, I think Rabbi Moshe Taragin mentioned this in a conversation with Rabbi Matanky over here in our neck of the woods, where he was trying to define what does it mean, the legacy of Agada B'Torah? And he said very simply, he thinks, and for personally, for sure, I hope and daven very hard, anyone can have a teacher who influences them. He said, Agada B'Torah influences you and can also influence your children.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. I have nothing to add to that. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you. Anyway, it's a pleasure getting better acquainted with you, Rabbi Goldstein. Believe it or not, this is only the third or fourth conversation that we're having, the two of us. But of course, we are already chaverim ludeya in our shared relationship to the Torah of Yeshivat Haaretzion, and specifically of Moreno v'Rabbeinu, Rav Aaron ben Yechiel, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And let's be Zoche, hopefully soon again, to gather, if not on Zoom, hopefully in person, and hopefully in Eretz Yisrael, to be able to learn Torah together again. Thanks to everyone for being on the call tonight. Again, thanks to the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel for giving us this opportunity to gather together, the two of us, Congregation Or Torah and the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel. I wish everyone a Laila Tov. Zai Gesund.